one session. Judge Johnson, Judge Ross, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
You may please be seated.
I almost forgot what we say in the Court of Appeals during in the courtroom. Apologize for that. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, I will say that today's date is May 26, 2022. This panel of the court today has six cases on its oral argument calendar, three of which will be submitted with oral argument and three of which will be submitted without oral argument solely on the briefs. And we're doing two oral arguments in the courtroom and then the third one via Zoom by request of the parties. The first case set for oral argument today is A22-45, Jane Doe 126 by and through Father Doe 126 versus Minneapolis Public Schools, District Number 1, and Septran Inc. And those are the two respondents on appeal, I believe. I understand from my law clerk, the marshal, that respondents have divided their time 9 and 6 with Mr. Markowitz to go first on behalf of Septran.
Yes, sir.
Okay, we will plan on that. Counsel for appellant, you may approach and introduce yourself and your client or clients and then begin your argument.
Thank you, and may it please the court and counsel. This case is that recurring nightmare that litigators have. As we wake up at night.
If you could just state your name for the record.
You bet. I apologize. It's been a while for me, too. My name is Patrick Noaker, and I represent Jane Doe 126. Like I said, this is the case that wakes us up at night. As you might imagine, this one has awakened me many times now. In your dream, you realize you've missed a deadline. And in this case, it's not Safeco Insurance Company that you failed. It's an 8-year-old little girl. If you can give me just a second.
Sure.
So I'm here to ask for help. I'm not a big crier. I'm here because I made a mistake. And this kid isn't going to get justice. And I'm asking for it. Septran, in their brief, described my honesty as noble. As you can tell, it's not. It's a lawyer who's practiced 32 years and just made a mistake, his first. I'm here because the district court denied my request. In so doing so, and as I say in my briefs, it abused its discretion when it denied my relief. I think everybody agrees that we start the legal analysis with the Finden versus Kloss case, Cole versus Wetzke. Give us the framework that we have to use when something like this happens.
Of course, if the district court was correct regarding the debatably meritorious factor, then for lack of a better term, the burden that you're carrying is not as appropriately entirely on your shoulders. There's less of a consequence if the district court is correct. I mean, if your case against the defendants, not the actor, but the institutional defendants, wouldn't survive then there's not really a consequence to the oversight that you're talking about, correct?
Well, the district court was not correct, so I'm not going to concede on that.
No,
and I'll talk about that.
But hypothetically, if the district court was correct, if we agree that the district court was correct, and if we're correct that the district court was correct, just again hypothetically, not saying what we're going to do in this case because I don't know, then you'd recognize the burden isn't so heavy on your shoulders.
Well, I do have to prove all four Findon factors. That is correct, but we'll not know that. That's part of the problem here. We aren't going to know whether we can't prove our case against Subtran or the school district, are we? Because we aren't even allowed to look at personnel files, look at incident reports, take depositions, any of those things. And that's...
Can I ask you on that point, and I sensed from your brief that that was kind of interwoven throughout the argument that it's... especially the argument of respondents that the allegations are conclusory and therefore we can't even find sufficient facts to support a debatably meritorious claim. And now you just made that comment as well. My question to you is this. It seems like your argument is more akin to a Rule 12 analysis where pretty much the allegations are presumed to be true, and if any facts could be obtained to support those allegations, then it survives Rule 12, at least to get to the summary judgment, the point you're making now. But aren't we really at a significantly different analysis since it has been dismissed, deemed dismissed with prejudice? So now in order to get it open, there has to be facts you have now or had at the time of the district court in order to obtain, for instance, that first factor debatably meritorious claim.
According to Cole, the Supreme Court's been very explicit and clear that they have not ruled or determined whether any information in addition to a well-pleaded complaint is required in order to grant a Rule 60-02 motion. So no, I do believe that this is where, because Judge Moore's a good judge, and this is an easy mistake to make. What happened here is that I believe the standard that he required was too high. It's too high. He held us to a summary judgment standard, and that's not consistent with the law.
How do you square that, though, with Cole reaffirming the case law that it must be more than conclusory? So, in other words, that seems like two separate issues. One is they declined and didn't need to in that case because the parties felt that I don't think there was a dispute, there were sufficient allegations. But it has to be more than conclusory. So well-pleaded facts, doesn't that require facts in addition to the conclusory allegation? And that's what Judge Moore focused on the absence of when it comes to foreseeability.
And Judge Moore gave two examples of things that he would expect to see at this stage. And in fact, they're the same arguments that Septron and the school district are making. Should have pled facts that was a well-known hazard in the school bus industry, or that they had actual knowledge that this perpetrator had sexually assaulted before. Judge Moore didn't say the well-known hazard, but he said words that were the same, under the same circumstances, I think he used. And when we really look at that expectation and where those expectations come from, those are all summary judgment expectations. In order to produce, because if I would have said it's foreseeable because it's a well-known hazard, that would have been just as conclusory as that the sexual assault was foreseeable. There would have been no additional facts that I could have added in order to establish more than that required expert testimony. And I think I cite in my reply brief a series of cases that describe what this well-known hazard is. I'm very familiar with that. I fight it almost every case. The second, actual knowledge, again, that is information. So I have to prove, but not only that this guy may have done this before, but that Septran and the school district knew it. Now, where is any plaintiff going to get that information without engaging in some discovery?
Well, it depends on the circumstances. I mean, obviously, and there may be a situation where the perpetrator where there's public knowledge or where there's information of convictions or something you could say should have known. But as a legal standard, is it fair to say after Cole and the other cases that have sidestepped the question of what the standard is, that we're sort of somewhere greater than a 12B6 motion, a Rule 12 motion, and less than summary judgment, but there's something more than just the complaint? It seems to me that even though the Supreme Court hasn't said exactly what the standard is, that the analysis the Supreme Court has undertaken seems to suggest somewhere in between. Would you agree with that, or what would you have us say if we were to interpret that even though the Supreme Court hasn't said so, what standard should we apply?
The Supreme Court has not indicated that anything other than a well-pleaded complaint is required. It is specifically said. We have not ruled on that. So, I'm in the same position as everybody in this room. How do we interpret that? Is this a complaint plus standard? Because this isn't what we're talking about. Complaint plus. Because if that's the case, well, in this case, there was no Rule 12 motion. There was no motion for more definite statement. In fact, there was no litigation about how inadequate the complaint was. In fact, it was answered by two of the defendants.
Well, that's because the burden shifts at this stage. It'd be back on the plaintiff as opposed to a defendant seeking dismissal and summary judgment or Rule 12.
But Cole, as the Supreme Court said, that a well-pleaded complaint, the Supreme Court has not held that additional information in addition to the well-pleaded complaint. Just for the record, by the way, I want to be clear, there was affidavit information. I submitted an affidavit. There was more than the complaint here. On the issue of foreseeability, see what we're doing, this is summary judgment, right? This is how it works. There was significantly more additional information submitted to the court. In fact, the factors 3 and 4, you know, he used that information to find that we'd met our burden. The issue, and you do note that of all of the legal contentions in this case, only one is the subject of this, of the objection and the subject of the opposition. So I the reason I'm doing that is I think it's only fair to carve down, and if we look at this, that analysis is summary judgment. So, that is too high of a standard. It is unrealistic and frankly unfair to require plaintiff to, when their lawyers made a mistake, come in and be able to prove their case without having access to the personnel files, incident reports, and information that all of the cases that have been cited, the Columbia High School District case, the Evangelical Lutheran case, all those are summary judgment cases. So we start using those as precedent, and we're requiring too much. And that's, I think I've argued that, and I'm sure I've been more too clear.
Can you speak a bit to the reasonable excuse?
Yes.
Element, because that's one, clearly the Cole has made it pretty clear that's a matter of pretty broad discretion in the district court as to the determination of whether the excuse is reasonable, which doesn't get us into the uncertainty of meritorious and debatable factor.
Absolutely. The evidence that was submitted to the district court and that is in the record here, I think that's important, that's what we look at. And what's in the record is I made a mistake. There's some discussion of, well, we made a settlement. We told them to make a settlement demand. The same day I called back and said, well, why don't we get a mediator involved? This is a kid. You know, there's a lot of dynamics that go around this. 3 days later, no. Okay. To conclude that was somehow disinterest in the case by these plaintiffs is an abuse of discretion. That's exactly what I'm saying. To make that jump, and I would challenge here, I don't know that Judge Moore would make that same conclusion today, because Judge Moore had to make a decision, or did make, he didn't have to, he made a decision on this 6002 motion and didn't have the opportunity to hear all of the evidence against the perpetrator, significant evidence about what was going on with this kid and how her parents were struggling to help her and care for her and get her the help she needs. And I don't think Judge Moore would make those same conclusions having now known that this family was hardly disinterested. Overwhelmed? Absolutely. They were absolutely overwhelmed. Still are. Still are. They hired a good lawyer to handle the legal stuff. So to somehow conclude that the fact that we didn't want to engage in settlement negotiations because it somehow led to us not filing this lawsuit and showed a lack of interest in this case, just was absolutely wrong. And that is an abuse of discretion. So that is one of my points.
Could I return you to a fairly narrow issue, though it goes back to Findon Factor 1? In the complaint, your complaint seemed to be unsure as to whether the perpetrator defendant was employed by the school district and or the bus company, but it looks like, and the judge made a point, reference this, that from the answers that he clearly was not employed by the school district, but only by the bus company. Doesn't that at least end that portion of the debatably meritorious as it applies to the school district?
It'd be easier for me to concede that, but I don't know that's true. I know that SEPTRAN has contract with Minneapolis Public School District, and I know that they operate buses to deliver children to and from school. I don't know, when we're talking about failure to protect a child while they're participating at school, I don't know that that's a reasonable conclusion. I can't deny that SEPTRAN admitted he was an employee of theirs, and the school district denies it. Those are facts we have to work with. I think, though, that analysis becomes a little more complicated when we really wade into it, especially in a situation where we have agency and contractual delivery of services that are the school district's responsibility.
So, Mr. Okay. Noka, I have one more question about the first requirement. Your complaint alleges that defendant Balthazar Hernandez was convicted of second-degree crim sex conduct, and the district court made a similar finding. Do we know, does the motion record reflect how he was convicted, whether it was by jury trial or guilty plea?
Yeah, he pled guilty.
And that's in the record?
I believe that's in the record.
Okay.
Yes, I believe that's in the record.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think I attached it to my affidavit as part of this motion.
Okay. Your time has expired, but you will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondents may introduce themselves and their clients and present their arguments.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Jeff Markowitz. I represent co-respondent SEPTRAN. SEPTRAN respectfully requests affirmance. And this appeal ultimately comes down to three general things: the burden of proof, district court discretion, and established law. I have two points I'm hoping to make as to each of the factors in addition to the briefing or in supplement to it. As to factor one, this is not a case where I think we need to hem and haw over where are we on the scale between Rule 12 motions and Rule 56 motions, because this is a conclusory assertions case. It's not a facts case that, just like a stool may have four legs by design, if it doesn't have one of those legs installed, it's not a debatably meritorious stool. And the same way a claim with elements that's missing any allegations factually at all to indicate in any way one of those elements is not a debatably meritorious claim. And that's what we have with the two claims, the negligence and vicarious liability. They judge foreseeability by different standards, but they still require a factual basis of some sort. And we don't have that in this case. And ultimately, that's why the burden of proof is so important here. The appellants had the burden to develop the record with favorable evidence, and the district court exercised its discretion to conclude they did not do so, and that was reasonable and at the very least not an abuse. The second point deals with the reasonableness of the excuse, and two pieces there. One, it divides down into two issues, and one is a question of law, and one is a question of attribution. And the question of law is very straightforward under Whipple and Charson in Carson and this court's recent, although not precedential, decision in Curtin. The mere forgetfulness or carelessness, and I mean no disrespect by using those terms, that's the language of the case law, that's not enough to establish reasonable neglect. And on the attribution side, this is a big picture matter. The district court had 2 years before it, roughly 21 months, of essentially what was inactivity. A case sued out, and then that was entirely dormant, notwithstanding the glimpses that we have in the record of what was done. Zeptran requesting a settlement demand twice, and that was the last word. It wasn't a shutting down the discussions. It was, we don't want to mediate, but what would you like? Let's see if it's in the realm of possibilities, and then silence to this day. And as to the discovery piece, MPS's discovery request, which wasn't responded to for more than a year later after this motion practice. And we know plaintiff's law firm attempted coordination that with the DOES because plaintiff's counsel's affidavit tells us that, and that apparently was unsuccessful. So this is what the district court had before it. It was a big picture story. And the question is whether we will carve out the failure to timely file from these other indications where we know client involvement was called for and yet nothing happened. And the district court did not abuse its discretion by concluding that these should not be carved out. There was a question as to the Walsh.
As to the legal standard.
Yes.
Your brief doesn't argue, and I assume you're not arguing, that the complaint would have been legitimately subject or reasonably subject to a Rule 12 motion for failure to state a claim.
That's not an argument we're presenting, Your Honor. I think these are materially different circumstances.
But just so we're clear, what is the legal standard that you believe we should apply if you acknowledge that a Rule 12 motion would not have been successful? Are you arguing for a summary judgment standard in effect?
Absolutely not. It's the Cole standard, and I think the clarification that's warranted is this. Cole speaks of specific information that clearly demonstrates a debatably meritorious claim. This, whether you can use a complaint or not issue, I think just speaks to that first part, and whether your specific information can come in the form of your allegations in the complaint as opposed to an affidavit or document production of that sort. And so just blending the Cole standard with the complaint issue here, it's just the question would be, is there specific information alleged in the complaint that clearly demonstrates a debatably meritorious claim? And here there is not. And I think that the difference between Walsh and Rule 12 context and this can't be understated. And that is this. In the Walsh context, necessarily, the plaintiff has not been given the opportunity to conduct discovery. And that's the opposite is true here. And we cite a rule of civil procedure in our briefing that indicates, and we've seen this in practice, where we're a pocket service state in Minnesota. You can conduct lots of discovery before the court ever knows that the action is a thing, before it, he ever sees the complaint. And that actually happens in these cases, in Carson, from the Temple Israel, there was discovery exchange that's discussed, and it does appear that that, in part, is what Mr. Carson may have relied on to sustain his Rule 60 burden in that case. I cite the court to Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 2604. It speaks of, essentially, once you commence your discovery conference, I mean, that holds back a lot of discovery, but then you may continue, but none of that happened here. And the problem of, well, there's not enough information, that is of the DOE's doing. There's no indication that they attempted discovery, nor did they, and that there was any problem with the defendants being dilatory. This is a no-facts case. It's not an insufficient facts case, and it's not an insufficient opportunity case. I also note that the claims are separate. There's the negligence claim that calls primarily for information in the defendant's custody. But then the vicarious liability question makes a broader claim. It's there must be a well-established industry, well-known industry hazard. And if child sex abuse by a bus driver is foreseeable in that way, that information should exist somewhere in the outside world. There should be experts available who can testify to that. Not to say that they have to provide a full opinion initially, but if there's going to be an expert consultant or litigation expert eventually, nothing stops the plaintiffs, nothing stops the does from providing a contingent opinion. Someone who says, I research in this area, I've opined on this matter in the past, I would be prepared to, depending on the facts, that also was available, but that also didn't happen. This is not a case where the district court set the bar too high. The district court simply recognized there was a bar and said no facts were there to meet this essential element, which was Bentonize, a precedential decision from this court in the breach of contract context. It was a single element that was lacking, the breach part, very important. There was only conclusory assertions, and we cite this in our briefing, Bentonize, and the court concluded that was not enough to say the district court abused its discretion or clearly erred.
On this, Mr. Markowitz, on the second requirement, you provided briefing. I mean, these cases generally, sometimes the district court might point to counsel's lack of counsel's failures, sometimes to the party's failures. Usually it seems like cases come up to us where the district court has relied on the lawyer's failures, and then the case law discusses whether that's abuse of discretion or not. In this case, am I correct in understanding, I think the district court did not rely on the lawyer's failure as, for lack of a reasonable excuse, but just relied, you know, principally or solely on the party's failures. Would you agree?
A little bit of no and more, or a little bit of no, I don't agree, but a little bit of yes. As to the no, the district court parsed through the explanations for the excuses provided by counsel given in his affidavit and concluded that they were lacking. So in that case, the court engaged with it. The court did not cite to the case law. We've provided this court with a Whipple and Carson and Curtin, which establishes as very straightforward Minnesota law, mere forgetfulness and carelessness are not enough, consistent with the federal courts. But the court did focus on the attribution piece, I think because, at least as a matter of fairness, to say this is not simply the innocent client situation. There was a father doe involved, not just a girl under 10. When you look at these other areas of inactivity, I see my time has expired. If I could wrap up that point.
Please.
If you look at those other areas of activity, that bolsters the point. But the court honestly never needed to get there, and this court can affirm on any grounds. And if you look at Carson and Whipple Curtin, that's the excuse provided is insufficient, but the court did go further to explain why it was fair in these circumstances.
Although time has expired, might I inquire?
Yes.
One further question? So should the district court have given more consideration in as to whether to look at the reasonable excuse factor from the standpoint of the client versus the lawyer? Should the Supreme Court have given some attention to the fact that this is not a case? You mentioned an adult, maybe an adult. I mean, that's one circumstance, but not the kind of sophisticated client that is frequently involved in litigation, where you've got a corporation with a legal team, or someone who's been involved in litigation over time and is familiar with the process. Here you've just got a father and a daughter, as far as it appears from the complaint, a minor daughter. So did the district court, explain why the district court didn't give greater consideration to this being a purely lawyer mistake case as opposed to a lawyer and party mistake case?
I'm glad you asked that, and that's why I opened with burden of proof, and I think that's really important here. This record doesn't answer every question. It doesn't tell us a lot about what was happening behind the scenes. What the appellants wrote in their reply brief is the most robust explanation I've heard to try to connect the circumstances of this girl and the circumstances they were in, and that's not in counsel's affidavit. And the district court answered the questions based on the information it was provided. It was not required to draw inferences unwarranted by the record before it. It was required to look carefully at the facts presented. And as rereading the materials before today, I think it did that.
Right, but I mean, the idea that, well, there was a request for a proposed settlement, and, well, that should be the district court seemed to put some weight on the fact that the the client had bore some responsibility under the circumstances because of that. But in practical litigation, it's an unsophisticated client's going to rely upon the lawyer to know when to step in and whether there's some response required and when to provide that response.
Two responses, Your Honor. One is, I think the Randall decision cited by MPS addresses this. It was a situation with what was presumably not the most sophisticated client who missed going to trial. And he said that the lawyer didn't tell me. And the Minnesota Supreme Court there said that's not enough to warrant this sort of vacation. But the other response is, I think the point we're trying to make in this appeal is abundantly practical. And this is the trip metaphor that was not meant to be flippant in any way, but simply to say that the basic questions that even the most unsophisticated of parties would have asked, or conduct you would expect them to demonstrate if they weren't in some way unusually disinterested in the case, didn't happen here, or apparently didn't happen. When is trial? When do we get a monetary recovery? This is why we sued this out. This is why we got a lawyer. And it seems like we don't know, but we must take this record in the light most favorable to the decision. It seems like that wasn't happening, or else experienced counsel would have had a tip-off sometime before that 21, 22-month period to say, oh, gosh, we need to sue this out. We need to get a scheduling order or a protective order, because if we're going to produce documents, we need to make sure that's lined up. That if we're going to get trial, we need a trial date or a ready date schedule. These are practical things that would have been set in motion had the clients in the background not been disinterested. And at the very least, the district court didn't abuse its discretion by saying, given what little I have before me from the party with the burden of proof and the parties without that burden, I think there was disinterest here, and I think that played a role in what happened.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Markowitz. Mr. Schaefer, you may approach and introduce yourself and your client and begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. I think it's still morning. May it please the court and counsel, I'm Christian Schaefer. I'm here today on behalf of Special School District Number 1, Minneapolis. And since I only have about 6 minutes, I want to start by just agreeing with Mr. Markowitz. I think the district advances or agrees with just about everything he said. There's one caveat, a question you posed earlier, Your Honor, what the standard is. Cole certainly is the standard, and I agree with Mr. Markowitz 100% that it requires specific information to plead. I would also like to point the court's attention to GAMS, specifically where the Supreme Court said that the decision whether to grant Rule 60.02 relief is based on all the surrounding facts of a specific case. And I think, and is committed to the sound discretion of the district court to finish the sentence. And one of the facts of this case, Your Honor, is that the school district did not employ the bus driver at issue in this case.
So where does the district fall in the question that I asked earlier, maybe to both counsel, which is the standard under the debatably meritorious element, which is it, Rule 12 plus? Is it something more than Rule 12 and less than Rule 56? What exactly is, I mean, obviously the Supreme Court has expressly not stated the standard, but what exactly is the standard based upon the Supreme Court's reasoning in these cases?
I believe it does fall between Rule 12 and Rule 56, and that's, in my opinion, based on the specific information language in Cole, which is more than mere conclusory pleadings that might otherwise survive a Rule 12 motion, and then this light of the specific circumstances. Counsel for appellant mentioned that on the other factors, the court did look at an affidavit, which treated that part more like summary judgment, and if it truly was a Rule 12 standard, that would not have, you know, come into play there at all. So I think it is an elevated standard, but certainly less than Rule 56. I'm not asserting that is the standard. However, I don't know, as Mr. Markowitz said, I don't know that we need to get to what the official standard is, particularly on the vicarious liability claim against the school district. Your Honor, you asked, doesn't that end the inquiry that the school district doesn't employ the bus driver? And the answer to that is an unequivocal yes. It is axiomatic that an entity cannot be vicariously liable for the acts of someone who is not their employee.
Can I stop you for a minute? In this kind of a case, a Rule 60 motion to for relief from a Rule 5 dismissal.
Yes.
Is it appropriate for the Court of Appeals to look at the issues party by party or defendant by defendant and also claim by claim? Or is it more of an all or none decision?
I think
I should ask, is it appropriate for the district court to do that?
Yes, Your Honor. Each claim must be debatably meritorious on its own as opposed to some claim.
Is there case law that states that or illustrates that?
I am not aware of case law directly on point, Your Honor, no. I think it's in the analysis looking at each claim. I don't know that we've seen a multi-party claim reach a appellate level, you know, in that level of detail. Each claim needs to be debatably. Each claim must stand or fall on its own in litigation, from motions to dismiss to motions to summary judgment. I just don't see how that wouldn't be applicable to Rule 60.02.
I mean, the Rule 5 dismissal was not party by party, not claim by claim. It was just a general, you know, the entire case is dismissed. And so I guess I'm not sure that Rule 60 should operate in a parcel by parcel basis as opposed to wholesale, you know, undoing what was done by Rule 5.
And, Your Honor, I agree. The Rule 5 motion was decided wholesale. The district court did, however, analyze the claim against the school district separately, at least on this ground that they don't employ the employee.
Well, maybe, I mean, I guess the question perhaps is if, you know, hypothetically, if there's one claim against one defendant that is debatably meritorious and all the others are not, then, you know, what is the appropriate resolution of the motion by the district court, and similarly, what should this court do in that hypothetical situation?
And Your Honor, again, without any case law directly on point that I can think of, if there are no deliberately meritorious claims against, we'll say, the school district or one party, and there are debatably meritorious claims against the other party, I don't see how bringing the not debatably meritorious claims back into existence after they've been dismissed with prejudice advances either the interests of justice or the efficiency of the court.
What if it was on a different element than debatably meritorious, that the party that you're referring to, what if the district court based the decision only on no excusable neglect?
In that case, unless there was some unique factor that there was excusable neglect with regard to one versus the other, which I couldn't see in this case, certainly, or in any case, really, I would have to strain my brain to think about it, then I would agree that it is all claims together if it is that factor.
So even including Mr. Baltazar Hernandez, his claim survives. Everybody's claim survives under that hypothetical.
He was not even served, Your Honor, at the time that this happened.
Understood. But part of the same lawsuit, part of the same complaint?
If it was solely on excusable neglect, I could see that being a ruling. I don't think that it makes sense, and it certainly isn't in this case.
Well, it's certainly a thorny issue we don't have to resolve here.
I don't believe so. Your Honor, may I answer one more question that you asked earlier?
Yes,
I know
you
my
may.
Time is up.
Yes, you
Thank
may.
You. Judge Ross, you asked, or you stated that some of the information that the appellant said he did not have prior to suit was publicly available. I would like to point out, again, with regard to the school district, that the Minnesota Government Data Praxis Act makes certain information public, including employment status, first and last dates of employment, and specifically Minnesota statutes, section 13.43. To be quite blunt, and I don't mean to be flip, Your Honors, he could have asked if this person was ever employed by the school district, or he could have pled some facts to suggest some sort of joint employer.
You mean outside of even undertaking discovery? This is a
prior to. Absolutely, Your Honor. Anyone can call the Minneapolis Public School District and ask, did you employ Baltazar Hernandez, and if so, what dates? And additional information, too, such as discipline, the existence and status of complaints, and the final disposition of disciplinary action.
Wasn't that issue essentially resolved by all of the pleadings, the answers submitted?
I agree, Your Honor, absolutely. It was just a question that was asked, where would we have gotten this information? That information would have been publicly available without recourse to litigation at all, were he an employee. If there's nothing further, Your Honors, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. Mr. Noker, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you. The difference between Rule 12 and Rule 56, and we've been working in this area, but Rule 12, without the presumption that all the facts that are pled are to be believed or assumed accurate or correct, okay? But you take that presumption away, and it's now I have to prove, a plaintiff has to prove that all the facts, all the elements of the cause of action, I have the burden of proving that. That's Rule 56. So, maybe for us to talk about that.
Maybe something less than Rule 56, like maybe just a showing of some of something to leave the court with a sense of plausibility of reaching a determination of foreseeability, for example, in this case. Like some public prior charge or offense or prior discipline.
Right, and despite counsel for the school district, they would not have given me, has this man ever been disciplined for a complaint about any kind of mistreatment of children? We would not have received that.
Why are you saying that under the Data Practices Act? Why wouldn't that absolutely be what you would receive if you made a data practices request?
I don't believe that that's the case. I think that's confidential personnel information that they couldn't
under produce. The law, if he was disciplined.
Well, I mean, I guess maybe there, if he was formally disciplined, that may be true. But that's not the same thing as foreseeability. And that's not what the court said. That's not the same thing as foreseeability.
Right, but Judge Moore pointed out that lack of information was. I think he was looking for something like this. Like, you could say, well, this is why it should have been foreseeable. We don't know, without discovery, we don't know everything, but we do know there was discipline. Or we do know that there was this charge in some other state.
That is exactly what Judge Moore said. You are correct.
And that's all publicly available.
And I'm here to tell you, and foreseeability, by the way, comes in many forms, and we've talked about those. And that is a standard that is too high for a Rule 60.02 motion to require that a plaintiff prove those things, especially things that are in personnel file incident reports and things that are exclusively in control of SEPTRAN as the employer here.
Right, and to be clear, the Data Practices Act would only get you actual discipline. So if there had been an accusation that didn't result in discipline, that would be protected personnel information you wouldn't get.
That's correct. And other factors. He's gone off, in this case, he went off his route and parked so that he could sexually assault this girl. Had there been other incidents of that? So there's just a lot of information that could be there, but it might not be there. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. But with that said, I still think, you know, what we have, and Judge Moore, to his credit, he tried to navigate this area that is unclear in Minnesota law. It's like Complaint Plus. And how much is required? And what's the just thing to require? What really should be required to say, you know what, this plaintiff should not be punished for my mistake? And that's, I don't think anybody even disagrees that that's the law of Minnesota. So what should be required?
Can you speak to Judge Johnson's question about, and Judge Moore seemed to struggle with this also, or at least ask the question of the parties, the idea of the all or nothing question. Under this relatively rare procedural circumstance?
I will. Rule 60.02 is asking for relief from dismissal from under Rule 5.04. 5.04 dismissed the case with prejudice if it wasn't filed within a year. 5.04 only dismissed the cases against SEPTRAN and the school district here. In the case of the defendant, the perpetrator, he was served, and the case was filed within a year. So 5.04 wasn't even implicated in that portion of the case. So I will, if that's the question you're asking me to answer, I would answer that in the case, since our relief was requested from Rule 5.04, school district and SEPTRAN, especially because you can see the factual, you know, interwoven nature of the facts, those have to be decided. Either I get relief under 504 or I don't. I just don't believe that Findon was ever intended to be a sort out the claims circumstance. I think my time's up, so Thank you.
I have one more question, and I guess after having some dialogue with Mr. Markowitz, I'm going back to the second issue now, the second requirement. I went back and looked at that part of the district court's order, and I was reminded that there was, the district court did discuss some of the excuses that you had offered about why you and your firm had not filed within 1 year, and the district court rejected those. I mean, would you agree that that's a discretionary determination, and that if we defer to, if we find no abuse of discretion on that part of the analysis, doesn't that then mean that the second requirement's not satisfied?
If you find that, I guess you're saying there's two components to the second Finden factor. One is, did I screw up, and did I screw up, and did the client's indifference contribute to the screw up? Those are the two things that that the judge had to consider. Are you asking me, if you take out the client's indifference, would I prevail on number two? And I think that as I read the court's order, I would prevail on Finden factor number two, because it was a mistake that I made. I'm not trying to excuse anything. I hope nobody's experiencing that.
Well, let me state it a different way. So, I mean, I think the court potentially could look to, the attorney's actions and the party's actions.
Yes.
And the district court discussed both. But, I have some questions about the court's analysis with respect to the individual parties. It seemed, just speaking for myself now, it seems to me that when discovery is responded to and when a complaint is filed with a court are typically in the real world matters for the attorney, not a responsibility that's placed on the party, a represented party, to carry out that function. So it seems to me that we shift our focus. We should not, by asking were the plaintiffs blameless. I think the answer to that, in my personal, again speaking for myself, is yes. But I don't know if that means that the second requirement is then satisfied. I think answering that question yes just means then it all depends on what we think about the attorney's conduct. We shift our focus solely to the attorney's actions. And if the district court determined that the excuses offered by the attorney are not reasonable, and that if the district court rejects those reasons, and if we conclude that in the analysis about the attorney's actions, the district court did not abuse discretion, it seems to me then that means the second requirement is not satisfied. Without, in other words, the blamelessness of the parties, the individual parties, is not consequential then. I don't know,
I understand exactly what you're saying.
If you understand my question, could you please tell me if that analysis is...
I think that's correct. If you don't find, let's take out the indifference of the plaintiffs and put it straight on, do I meet the second Finden requirement? By what's in front of the court, what's in the court's record, which was that the lawsuit was filed, couldn't get service on the perp, he was dodging service, we got affidavit of not found. For some reason in our system,
One more question, if I may, and that is, Mr. Markowitz cited a non-precedential opinion of this court, Jimenez-Moncayo, which surveyed the Court of Appeals opinions, precedential and non-precedential, kind of focusing on that second factor. And the court's opinion there kind of states that in most cases, the Court of Appeals has affirmed, has deferred to, has found no abuse of discretion by the district court with respect to the second factor, with a couple of exceptions which were a little bit unusual. And I don't know if you've looked closely at that opinion and that discussion, but I guess I'm wondering if there's something about this case that puts it in that unusual category that makes it more atypical than typical, if you understand my question.
I don't believe up to the 1 year deadline that there's anything atypical that I can cite to this court. I think we can all clearly understand how it took a little longer to find this error because we were all remotely working in a global pandemic. So yes, that is unique. Finding this error did take longer but not filing it within a year, I've been quite clear about what happened. I think I might have to just allow the court to make that decision. Yeah. I hope it's, I don't want to excuse my actions because it's not excusable. So thank you.
Looking for any further questions? It appears there are none. So thank you for your rebuttal argument. Thank you to all counsel for your arguments. They were very helpful in a important case. So the court will take this case under advisement and will issue its written opinion within 90 days. Thank you.